Hello and welcome to episode 8 of the second series of the Old Songs podcast, supported so very kindly by the English Folk Dance and Song Society. And it's an unusual one this week as it focuses on an old tune rather than an old song. So prepare yourself to delve into the background of one of the most well-known Morris dancing tunes, The Princess Royal. With me to discuss the tune is one of the country's finest melodeon players and a fellow I've been lucky enough to play the tune with on a number of occasions, John Spires, or Squeezy as he's so fondly known here on the English folk scene. Many of you will know Squeezy as a founding member of Bellowhead, not to mention a myriad of other bands that he steps in and out of when the road calls. The first time I ever heard The Princess Royal, Squeezy was playing it, so I'm delighted I managed to grab him between tours to record this episode. Over the next hour or so, we'll be looking at the history of the tune. Did it start life as an accompaniment to English Morris dancing, or does it stretch further back and over greater distances than that? Squeezy tells us a bit about growing up, somewhat hesitantly, in the Morris tradition, and talks about the difference between being a musician performing this tune on stage and a musician playing for a Morris side to dance to. He explains what a jig is, what a reel might be, how to recognise a slow, and who's wearing the truncles in this relationship anyway. So Squeezy mentions video clips and different versions throughout, and I'll include YouTube links and a list of the versions on the Tradfolk page accompanying the podcast. So have a mooch about over there when you have the time. But hello, John. Hello, Squeezy. Do you prefer to be called Squeezy or John?
Squeezy makes it easier in a world filled with Johns.
As this podcast demonstrates, I suppose. But welcome to the Old Songs podcast, and thank you for doing this, because actually this is the first time we've ever done a tune rather than a song.
Yes, it's a challenge, but I think we've chosen a good one.
Yeah, and you're the right man to do it, I think. Today we're going to talk a little bit about this tune that I think everybody who gets into traditional music stumbles upon fairly quickly, and it's quite common that they fall for it quite heavily. It seems to be an extremely popular tune, The Princess Royal. But before we go straight into that, I want to talk a little bit about you and who you are and sort of what your background is and that kind of thing, just to set the scene. I mean, obviously, you're kind of well known for your work with Bellowhead and, you know, Peter Knight, Jackie Oates, Salt Lines, Mr. John Bowden. But you're also obviously sort of quite heavily intertwined with the Morris tradition, aren't you? Is that purely as a musician, or have you ever been a dancer as well?
It's more as a person than even a musician, really. I have had a go at Morris dancing, but it's never been a big thing of mine to be a dancer. I've always been more intrigued about being part of the music. But it stems to the fact that I grew up in a family where my dad was a Morris dancer. And as with anything, your influences are anything that comes into your ears. And so being around these catchy, repeated every weekend tunes, it builds a kind of muscle in the ear of a budding musician, the same way as listening to the radio, and when the big pop hits are played over and over again, they're catchy as well. They go into people's heads and they can sing them for the rest of their lives if they've been growing up with them. And so it was just part of my life. And I don't even know the first time I heard The Princess Royal being played. I've no idea when that was. There's no sort of, oh, I liked that tune. It sort of came out of this blur of childhood. Mm. And I didn't have any active participation in it during that time. I was normally sort of given a packet of crisps and a bottle of lemonade and sat under a tree somewhere or a park bench making my own amusement while it went on in the background, and obviously took a bit of interest in it because it was going on, but it was just part of life.
Did you enjoy it? Did you rebel against it?
I did. I sort of rebelled against it. I think I went through several phases. I'd learnt instruments at school, but obviously the music we were doing at school wasn't necessarily folk in any way. And I do remember that sort of late primary school age, I used to take a recorder along because I'd started to get bored. And I'd just try and pick up these tunes because they were in my head, and I played by ear. So I'd play the little recorder along to the musicians. There's a few pictures of me playing for, I think, the Oxford University Morris Men that my dad used to dance for sometime in the 80s. Very soon after that, it sort of became the age where I could stay at home and not have to come out with my parents when they went and did that. And I chose that instead. It wasn't something I hankered after particularly.
You and I are roughly the same age. I kind of think of you as somebody who is so sort of steeped in tradition and involved in the traditional scene. Were you listening to other music in the 90s? Were you a kind of 90s kid as well?
I wasn't listening to any folk music. I suppose in the early 90s, I was still at school, going into sixth form. But it was quite a heavy metal town I grew up in, Abingdon. There was a lot of heavy metal fans. And so I'd end up at parties where there'd be some pretty heavy stuff being played. And I got to know them, you know, it wasn't my bag particularly. And I had a smattering of albums of things that I liked, but there was no folk in there apart from my parents' music collection. I think the two main favourites that went on the road with us were some of the John Kirkpatrick albums my dad really liked. So I had this melodeon thing going on in my head. And then there's an album called Mr. Fox, which is incredibly dark sort of folk rock thing from late 70s or early 80s. And I haven't really heard it since, to be honest with you. I occasionally make sure I know what it was because I didn't know if it was Steel, I Span or Fairport. I think it was a one-off project thing. But there was that going on. It was just a thing that happened when we were on family holidays. It would be played because there's, you know, not much in-car entertainment in that time. So it would be on in the background.
Yeah.
And the other thing that my dad used to play was the Kipper Family, right, which was a kind of comedy folk act, taking the mickey out of folk acts that I didn't know at the time. So there's lots of, I learned lots of Martin Carthy parodies before I ever heard Martin Carthy. And it all sort of fell into play. It made more sense the more I got into folk as an older person. But yeah.
Oh, I can't imagine you as a metalhead. Does Metallica work on the melodeon?
I've never tried it.
Before we go into the song, I just want to know, you know, what work have you done with our illustrious sponsors, the English Folk Dance and Song Society? You must have been involved with them over the years.
Yeah, I mean, that's the brilliant thing about them being based at Cecil Sharp House and having the library and everything. I think my first encounter with the EFDSS was using the library. I joined specifically to use the library. Mm. I started playing with John Bowden. We first met in 1999. At that point, I was looking for new material, basically. And so in those very late 90s, I went down to Cecil Sharp House and found this library and just said, I don't know what to do here. I'm looking for some tunes. And I don't really read music either. And they said, well, I can't really help you with the not reading music. I think it was the librarian there, Malcolm, was very helpful and sort of said, well, what sort of tunes are you looking for? Like English ones, possibly early ones. And he took me to this cabinet of really original old source tune books. And I went in and copied stuff out without really knowing what they sounded like into a manuscript book because there were no digital camera smartphones at that time. So I sat laboriously writing these tunes out that I thought might looked promising, and had a few of these tunes to play when I went back into the sessions in Oxford. And since I can't remember the first time I played there as part of anything, but it's just been a constant throughout my whole playing career, is that I've been booked there. I've worked with various projects. Quite often the gigs at Cecil Sharp House are sort of, there's an added dimension. They're more interesting than just your book to play in front of people. It's often you're playing in a lineup with different acts that you might not have seen. They have cross-pollination where you might end up playing something at the end of the night with people you've never played with before. So it's very good for that kind of community thing. And then quite early on, I went to see one of my favourite dance bands. I do like Kaylee dancing, especially the French stuff. And I went to see Blowzabella, really sort of mid-2000s. So I've been there as a punter as well several times. And I think the most exciting one we did was bringing it all together on the Spires and Bowden tour we did after coming back after not having played for ages, we did a thing called the Spires and Bowden Festival at Cecil Sharp House, where we did, it was like a day where we played and hosted sessions and did a ceilidh, which was great. Really good sort of taxing thing, because I had to learn how to call ceilidh dances, which I've never done before.
Whilst playing?
Yeah, it was not something I think if there's a chance of working with a really good caller, I'd always choose that. But it was just quite nice, because it was quite funny that our two different calling styles were chalk and cheese, shall we say. And yeah, good fun.
Did that relationship with John develop out of an interest in folk? Is that how you came to know each other?
Well, I'd had an interest in folk since university years, which is sort of mid-90s, and when I got home, I found that there was an absolutely amazing session scene in the Oxford pubs in East Oxford, and so I'd been sort of haunting that and bumming around on the Oxford folk scene, just sort of occasionally getting gigs doing ceilidhs and things locally. We're in one of these late night sessions, and John Bowden just popped in unannounced, and we didn't know who he was, and he sat down and he was playing these sort of Irish fiddle tunes, but then he got up and started singing these belting English songs, and everyone was like, hang on, this is a bit different, no one's done that, you know. And he really, back in the day, he gave it some in the pub. So it was with that sort of pins you to the wall voice. And everyone in the pub was like, wow, my God, he's really good. And a lot of the older folkies sort of were prodding me, going, you should get together with him and do something. Well, we both did swap contacts and say, well, maybe we could do something, because both enjoyed what each other were doing. But we didn't phone each other for at least a year after that. Was so felt like that anyway. And John finally got in touch with me a good year down the line, saying, oh, I've got this gig that I've been promised I can have in Lewes, I think, because he didn't live in Oxford at the time. He said, do you fancy working some stuff up and doing playing with me on that? And that was the first gig we did, I think.
Experience of this tune, actually, I bought a Melodeon about 4 years ago, which was probably a foolish thing to do, I'll be honest. Well, it's a sort of gathered dust in the corner, and I think I always say that I've bought it because I think it's going to sort of fend off dementia. It's a bit like doing a Rubik's Cube for me, you know, in future years it'll be keeping my brain active. But when I bought it, it was a recording of you and John Bowden playing Princess Royal and Speed the Plough going into each other.
Oh, yeah.
That kind of made me want to learn this tune, and I play a very rough, very bad version on the Melodeon. I can play it much, much more interestingly and better on the guitar now. But it's because of that recording that I became interested in this tune. So I'm really pleased that you agreed to come and talk about it. Because the other thing is, usually on these old songs podcast stuff, I do quite a lot of research and I know quite a lot about it, but I don't really know how to go about researching tunes. So I'm hoping you're going to teach me quite a lot today.
Yeah, well, that version with Speed the Plough is on Vagabond, I think.
Yes, that's
the album,
right.
Vagabond. And that's the minor version from Bampton that we play, although we play it a lot faster than Bampton danced to it on that recording. So the first thing you really need to know is that I came to the Princess Royal, as a lot of the English folkies did, through it being a Morris dance tune.
Yeah.
And there are two main variants. So the Bampton ones is one of the minor ones.
And of course, Bampton's in Oxfordshire, isn't it?
That's right. As are lots of the traditional Cotswold Morris teams, Oxfordshire, Gloucestershire.
So it's just up the road from you anyway, isn't it? Really?
Yeah, yeah, it is. Yeah. But the version I learnt first is the version that we recorded on Bellow, I think, in a medley with the Cuckoo's Nest. And that's based on the Abingdon version. Now, Abingdon and Bampton are about 11 miles apart, and they are sort of the two most polar opposite different versions of the tune that exist.
Yeah.
On the Morris scene anyway. I think one of the interesting things about it is it's got quite an unusual structure. So quite often, most dance tunes that you'll learn in sessions will have sort of a pattern of 8 bars of a first part of the tune that's repeated. Hmm. And then it'll have another pattern of 8 bars that is repeated again, and then it goes backwards and forwards between them. That's the sort of standard basic folk tune form.
I'm aware that sort of a lot of our listeners are probably a bit like I have been relatively recently, fairly new to a lot of this stuff. So when people talk about ABC parts, that's what they're talking about, right?
That's right, yeah. It's kind of, it works like, if you're thinking of a song, it's like a verse and a chorus, really.
Yeah,
you know, it has one set of melody for this bit, and then it goes to the next one, and then it goes back to the beginning again. But normally for dancing, because dances are kind of symmetrical, those parts tend to be the same length. But in the Princess Royal, the second part sort of goes off in a little world of its own, and so it is longer than the first part. Mm. And it has a really interesting structure, which the Morris dancers use to do quite interesting things when they're dancing as well. Mm. Because of that structure, the tunes are actually interchangeable to some extent between the different traditions' dances. Mm. Not always, but you could play the minor version for a team dancing a tradition that normally plays to the major version, and it would fit. There's a book of Morris dance sort of Bible called Lionel Bacon,
right.
Wrote. It's sort of like a little black folder that has lots of typewritten photocopied bits in it. I think there's 11 versions of the Princess Royal in there. 5 of them are major and 5 of them are minor, and one of them doesn't have a tune at all.
What? Wow.
Just the dances notated, yeah.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. So when you say the differences, the main differences between the Abingdon and the Bampton version, is that the difference between the major and the minor? Is one of them major and one's minor?
I think you'll find that those two versions are the most commonly played major and minor versions in sessions, but there are lots of other variations as well. The Atterbury one is a very interesting one. It starts off like a minor tune, and then... Can I demonstrate it on my melodeon? Because that'll make more sense than trying to talk about it. So the minor version you're talking about is the Bampton one. It goes... The Abingdon major version, which is, I think a lot of people that have got into folk music possibly earlier on know an album called Morris On.
Yeah.
And the Abingdon version is pretty much that one. That, in fact, when the dancers start, they don't play the tune immediately. They sing a little song to a different melody, and then they go into the tune when the dancers start. So that tune will be... That's the basic major and minor ones. The Atterbury one is interesting in that it starts off minor and then goes major and only finishes off being minor. So... So it's kind of halfway between the two. There are so many different variations in the Morris teams. And you find that with all of the tunes. You know, the Morris dances are from these different villages spread out over the Cotswolds and sort of to the west of the Thames Valley. And those tunes will be different in different villages. And you can hear possibly closer villages are often similar. The Abingdon and Bampton things unusual in that they're so different. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you'll have a dance with the same name but a completely different tune that the fiddler decided, well, we'll keep the name of the dance but we'll change the tune. It depended on what the musician could play really at the time. And then they passed that on to whoever was next. And so it's that lovely oral tradition thing of it always being a bit dynamic and a bit changing all the time. And you can sort of trace these quite organic changes in the tune and how it's gone. But this tune's really interesting in that it probably didn't start off as a Morris dance tune. In fact, it probably didn't start off as an English tune.
Oh, right. Okay.
Almost definitely. The way that tune became popular enough to be used as a dance tune for Morris teams is a long, long journey that starts off in at least the early 1700s. Would you like me to tell you a bit about that?
Please, yeah.
One of my favourite sayings in folk is that everyone likes to nick a good tune. Right. And that's very true with this one.
Yeah.
And when it goes across national boundaries, people like to claim it comes from their country.
Of course.
Most of the evidence points to the fact that this tune was written as a tune called Miss McDermott by the blind harper Turlough O'Carolan in Ireland about 1725. The only question is, did that tune exist before and did he just sort of appropriate it, again happens? If you listen to that version, you can tell it hasn't had all its rough edges knocked off. And by that, I mean, when people write very ornate, flowery pieces, the more it goes through the folk tradition, the more people leave out the bits that aren't absolutely essential for it to be the tune. So actually, the O'Carolan harp version, Miss McDermott's, is absolutely recognisable as this tune. It has the structure, it has everything that the Morris dance tunes have. But it's got more going on. It sounds more almost classical. They've done sort of genealogy and found that there was at that time a Miss McDermott in the area that he wrote it in, Roscommon.
Wow.
And he used to travel all around Ireland sort of writing tunes for the and playing for the high end society in Ireland at the time. There's a sort of question mark because it wasn't called the Princess Royal then. By 1730, it was already appearing in tune books in England. So these dancing masters and people that would write the latest tunes for the latest dances, it appeared in a thing called Walsh's as the Princess Royal, the New Way in 1730, which can only have been 10 years or so since Carolan wrote it. Mm. So it's interesting how that happens.
Must have been very popular straight away then.
Well, I think so. And it appears again in later 1700s in a Scottish collection by Nathaniel Gow as the Princess Royal. And that has been changed quite a lot from the O'Carolan version. Mm. In fact, some of the Morris tunes are more close to the Carolan version than this Scottish one. But it's definitely the same tune looking at it. And then there are several things that point to it getting popularity in England, particularly around that late 1700s, early 1800s, in that a chap in Durham took the melody and set words to it, I think, from a poem. And it was a very jingoistic sort of song about a ship called the Arethusa. And that song was in a musical that was performed in London. And what often happened with popular musicals is if there was a song that people liked, they'd take that back and then it would get performed in its own right in the music halls, presumably, you know, around the early 1800s was particularly flag-waving naval warfare time in Britain. And I'm sure they like their songs about beating the French and whatever. It's a long way away from a tune from Ireland.
Is there any thought on what the name means? Is it referring to, you know, the eldest daughter of the monarch, or is it a ship? Or
they think that because the time when the tune emerged in the early 1700s, there was a new Princess Royal, was a title given to... there's not always a Princess Royal. And I don't know if it might have been the first use of that term in the royal family, but it was a popular thing to name things after. So I think as a tune and a dance, it was just named in honour of the new Princess Royal.
The brief amount of research I was able to do on it said that Cecil Sharp collected it on about 6 different occasions, 3 of which were in Bampton itself, but also Bledington and Loughborough.
Longborough.
Is that what it's called? Okay.
I don't know of a Loughborough Morris tradition.
Okay. Cecil Sharp's an interesting one again, because he's obviously, he turns up a lot in songs. And I think people who love traditional folk songs know of him as a song collector. But isn't it the case that he was involved in Morris and became fascinated by Morris and collecting Morris tunes before he found his way to songs?
He definitely was very, very involved in collecting and preserving the dances. The place where he first encountered Morris dancing was, he was staying Headington, which is a part of Oxford now, but was a village outside at the time. And Headington Quarry Morris men are a traditional Morris side that have been going back to nobody can remember, you know.
And they still exist.
Yeah, they do still exist, yeah. I can't remember, it was like 1898 or something. He was staying with whoever was living at the big house just outside. And it coincided with the time that they performed the Mummer's Play.
So Christmas-ish.
Yeah, so it was around Christmas time, and basically that was always a very dead period for the working men. The weather was bad. There was no agricultural work around. People were paid for the work they did. So when there was no work, there was often no pay. But the Morris team decided they'd get together and put on this Mummer's Play and take it out because they needed some money. So they go and put the hat out and hopefully get a few pennies. And Cecil Sharp was just in the right place at the right time when they were putting that on. And he met the chap who was in charge of the Morris team at the time, William Kimber, who was a great Anglo concertina player and a real local character. So he basically got all the music and he notated the dances, sort of wrote down what they were doing for all the different dances, came back several times to Headington, but it kind of spurred him on thinking, well, this sort of dancing at the time was falling out of favour. There were a lot of Morris sides actually never made it to meeting Cecil Sharp and having their traditions preserved, some of which had versions of the Princess Royal. And so he then went round the early 1900s. He collected loads and loads of different traditions. He was very much responsible for the Morris side of things. And interestingly, there are beautiful versions of the Princess Royal that were captured for some of these orphaned Morris dance tunes that never had their dances collected. So, for example, there's a village called North Lee, just outside Whitney, in the west of Oxfordshire. They had a Morris dance team. This tune was collected, and my family are from North Lee. You know, it's and I only very late in my life discovered that my great granddad played the melodeon in North Lee back in around that time. So I don't know. Well, the tonality of this tune isn't very melodeon friendly, so he probably didn't play this version. But there's a fantastic version of the Princess Royal from there, which actually is very close to the original O'Carolan one in its tonality and a lot of the twists and turns it takes. And it's, I don't know, it's got this kind of spooky feeling to it, because when I'm listening to it, I'm going, well, this is just like a ghost dance and nobody knows what the dance was, because all the dances have different flavours to them. I don't know, want to think how many versions there have been over time.
With that kind of knowledge of that history, do you feel a sense of place or sort of ownership of a tune like this when you perform it? Does it relate to where you come from?
Yeah, I suppose it does. I don't really think about it in that way, but I do think my love of the Morris tunes comes from being very familiar with them, as I said at the beginning, having grown up with Morris dancing. But I do love coming from where I come from, and anything that's associated with it is sort of part of me as well. And even if I come to some of these tunes later on, like this North Lee version that was uncovered, and that was collected by Cecil Sharp, just not with its dance. I love being able to join those dots.
She's from the village of Bampton, called the Princess Royal Jig, and probably the bit of
Tell me a little bit about the relationship between the musicians and the dancers in a Morris side. When you're playing as a Morris musician, how does that differ to being on stage with someone like John Bowden, for example, and playing this tune?
The main thing is you're there functionally for the dancers. You're not the act.
Yeah, of course.
If you're playing for dancing. And really what you're trying to do is track the team of dancers. If it's a six-man dance, you're trying to play to their footfalls, to where their footfalls look most comfy. And basically, once they start dancing, you get a very good idea of where the rhythm is. And in fact, the rhythm, you know, there's jigs and there's reels, and actually Morris dancing falls into a sort of gap in between the two a little bit with a lot of the stepping. You know, the tune might be going dump de dump de dump de dump like that in a 6-8 rhythm, but the feet are going da 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 da, and so you kind of pull the beats backwards and forwards to where the feet lie. And in very particular types of dances, there's a thing called a solo jig where or a double jig where dancers dance sort of ostensibly against each other and take it in turns to show off these quite difficult moves. And they have a thing in called slows, which is where the music slows right down, and they perform jumps and really complicated moves. And for that, you really have to play to the dancer. The Bampton version of the Princess Royal has beautiful slows in, but it means that There's no way you'd write it out how you play it, because you'd like to regularize everything when you write it out. And the dancer, if they land, you've got to be with them for the next move. So you're watching the feet the whole time. That's the reactive part of playing. But then there's this lovely thing with all dance music where if you finally fall into the same groove as the dancers, it becomes kind of effortless. And you can see their performance get better out of the music, and you can feel your music getting better out of the performance. So it doesn't often relate very well into recording it and listening back later, but in that time when you're doing it, that's when it's important. And it's a lovely thing to do. Yeah.
So again, just to cover off stuff for musical dunces like me, this is a jig, right?
No.
No, you see straight away a dunce.
Well, it is and it isn't.
Oh, okay, half dunce.
No, well, a musical jig is, it defines the 6-8 rhythm or possibly the 9-8 rhythm as well. So it's compound time, which means the tune, basically if a folk tune goes dumpty-dumpty-diddly-diddly-dumpty-dumpty-diddly-diddly, that sort of feel, then that's a jig musically. And if it goes dappa 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 dappa, it's a reel or a polka or something like that, and that's in 4-4 time. So that's the musical term jig comes from that. But of course, jig really just means a dance, and quite often a slightly fancy dance. And you can do slightly fancy dances to all kinds of different time signatures. So in Morris, a jig generally means a dance that is done by one person at a time rather than all six or however many there are in that tradition. So, and it's kind of a showpiece, the jig. So, yeah, a Morris jig doesn't necessarily need to be a musical jig. Princess Royal's in 4-4.
So The use of the term a jig is basically depends on the context. You just need to know so much.
It's like folk.
In general, yeah. So also, just as an aside, what is a truncle? That's another one that seems to come out of Morris.
You never have one truncle.
Oh, sorry, truncles.
Yeah.
Right.
It means trousers.
Oh, is it trousers? Okay.
It means trousers, yeah. It's an old word for trousers, and that's one of the names of a dance that is done called truncles, or sometimes it's called trunco or old trunk ho. I've been looking at a lovely collection from of versions of tunes called the Colford Jig, which is tunes from further west than the Cotswold region, but a lot of the tunes are the same. There are Princess Royals in there, some really weird versions of Princess Royals in there, generally from around the Forest of Dean. That's what a truncle is.
Right, okay. So, yeah, this is all about learning.
Oh, the sun shines bright and the corn grows high and the crows are gathering and the scarecrow sees and the scarecrow knows how the seasons change and the seasons roll.
It's also used in song, isn't it? I think the most recent sort of popular version that I've heard, or sort of well-known version I've heard, is the Unthanks have taken it in Mackenzie Crook's adaptation of Wurzel Gummidge.
Oh yeah, I love that version. I really love that version. That's so nice. Yeah, that's a recent adaptation of the tune.
And it's interesting. It's the minor tune as well, isn't it? That they've made.
It nearly always is with songs. I don't know many songs that have been set to the major version. I think the major version's it's quite uniquely English and very much centered on that Morris tradition. I don't know many uses of the tune in its major form elsewhere. Probably the most traditional setting of the notes of the Princess Royal to a song is there's a song called Bold Nelson's Praise. Again, similar to the Arethusa song, is about naval warfare. That's been covered by lots of famous folk artists back in the day. The Raggle Taggle Gypsies tune that a lot of people know is, again, based on Princess Royal or Miss McDermott's possibly. And so that's da 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 da. That doesn't have the same structure, but you can tell it's the same tune. And so yeah, Jim Moray's version on Sweet England of that. That's something I grew up with early on in my folk career, listening to a lot of.
Three gypsies stood at the castle gates. They sang so high and they sang so low. And the lady sits in a chamber light, and her heart melted away like snow.
What about other versions of the tune that you love in terms of recordings? I mean, we've mentioned a few.
Yeah, so the Morris On one is obviously a key. And the problem I have with recordings is that I often want a recording on my CD collection, Spotify, however people get it, of people I know playing it. And so my favourite way to listen to it is Matt Green, the fiddler.
He's the fiddler with Bampton, right?
He's the fiddler with one of the Bampton sides, yeah. And he's also plays in a band called Magpie Lane. Mm. He's never done a recording of the Princess Royal on his own, but I think there are a couple of YouTube clips. He does this thing where he plays the fiddle and dances it, the solo jig, at the same time. And it's absolutely stunning to watch him doing it. His fiddle style, he plays it right down in sort of the crook of his elbow rather than under his chin.
Yeah.
So it gives him his upper body a sort of a bit of a real lean into the tune. And he plays with a real musicality, but with kind of the rawness as well of the old Bampton fiddler that was first collected on recording doing it, Jinky Wells, who I don't think anyone would accuse him of being a splendid in-tune musician, but he certainly played in the right rhythm for the dancing.
Right.
And Matt has married that with really nice musicianship as well. And he, so that's on YouTube. But recording-wise, I suppose the Morris On one was the seminal one for me. When I first heard that, I thought, oh, hang on. There's this really rocky version of the one I grew up listening to the whole time. That was a surprise. And in fact, I have to make an admission. I'm quite a Clannad fan.
Right. Okay.
Again, that was to do with music that was in my house when I was growing up, I think, rather than their period with the Robin Hood music and everything.
That's all I know. Really.
I don't mind that stuff either, but their early stuff was very folk.
Yeah,
fairy folk, late 70s albums by Clannad. And there's a version of Miss McDermott's on the first Clannad album, which is just called Clannad. And that's a really nice harp version of the original. And so, you know, I love listening to those different intricacies of the tune that were there in the Carol Ann version.
What do you think it is about this tune that catches people's attention and brings people such joy?
It's very pompous, isn't the right word. It's very triumphant. There's in both versions. You know, it starts off with a da 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 bum ba da 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 bum ba. You know, it's a little repeated phrase, and then in that second part, just where it keeps sort of folding back in on itself. And you always think it's going to finish. And then you go, oh, it has finished. And then it goes back into that again. And I just think that the fact that it's not a straight two lots of eight bar phrases, and the way it kind of goes up and down the scale and plays around with things in both the major and the minor versions, I think it's lovely.
I remember playing it with Paul Sarton in the pub across the road from my house. I'd only just come to that tune. I loved that triumphant beginning bit. I could follow that really easily. I was playing accompaniment, strumming the guitar. And then we got into that B part, and I kept trying to go back to the beginning bit. And he used to sort of look at me with his eyes and sort of go, not yet, not yet.
It keeps going.
Exactly that. I loved it because of that, because it just... it kind of took you by surprise. And I think a lot of people who come into folk for the first time tend to think that folk music is quite easy. I don't know if they think it's because it's old and therefore it's going to be less complicated or something, but I think I meet quite a few people who just sort of will dismiss it and say, it's too simple. And then you get into playing something like that. And some of the many tunes that I've since had the pleasure of playing with you as well since, and you realise just how difficult it is.
It is. I mean, obviously, when you're playing for the Morris dancers, it suddenly makes sense. And I love the fact that all of the traditions have fitted this, because the tune came from outside. It wasn't originally for the Morris dancers. And there are other ones where they've had to invent bits to, you know, the dance keeps going on, or they wanted to put a little flourish in here and there. And so the tune, which you can sort of tell should finish.
Yeah,
they keep going round and round in circles. But actually, if you go back into the history of that tune, Jockey to the Fair is a classic one. You know, it should be da 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 da. Perfect eight bar phrases. But some versions go da 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 da
da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da very early on. Amazing. Tell me a bit about what's happening in your musical world. Like, what are you up to at the moment?
Right then. So I've had January off.
You were on the road all year last year.
Very, very busy last year. It's probably my busiest year as a touring musician ever because of all the reschedules and things post-COVID. But also, it's what happens. I didn't have a band back in 2016, and now I have everything that I've said yes to is on the road. So it's feast or famine, and I'm in a feast time. So I'm back on the road in a week and a bit with the Geekspanner Big Band. Mm-hmm. We've got a whole load of dates, and it's our only period where we're not doing the Salt Lines. We're doing the proper Geekspanner Big Band full set, the upbeat music stuff. Really looking forward to doing that again. It's an amazing band to be in with Peter Knight, Philip Henry and Hannah Martin, and the Geekspanner lads, Sasha and Roger. I've got that until March, when there's a few Salt Lines dates where we're taking the Salt Lines project, which is a collaboration between the Geekspanner Big Band and an author called Raina Wynn. And it's a show about, well, it's about life and stuff like that, but it's kind of based geographically around the southwest of England. Mm-hmm. And we've played that in the southwest of England. We've played it in some more venues further around in the south. We're taking that up north now and doing a run of dates up north. So if, you can find any of the dates I'm doing are on my on my website, johnspires.co.uk, and that doesn't matter which band I'm in at the time, they're all up there. Then I've got some dates with Peter Knight into April, and then we'll be on the road with Spires and Bowden into early summer, May and June. It's fairly busy. I do get some days at home now, hoping to sort my allotment out because it didn't do very well last year.
No, I bet. Thoroughly neglected. It would be wrong of me not to ask, but how was the Bellowhead experience last year?
Oh, wow, it was amazing. It was really good fun. I was pretty nervous about it, not having been on a big old tour and a tour bus for years, thinking, oh, God, I'm a middle-aged man now. I'm swanning around on a tour bus, showering in dressing rooms and things like that. But within a day, it was just like, you know, when you go back into an old routine, it's like, oh, I remember how to do this. Yes, fine. And we really enjoyed each other's company on the tour. It was hard because of not having Paul at such short notice, obviously. And the band were very sad about that.
Of course, yeah.
We put something in the show to try and honour him as much as we could.
Wonderfully.
But it was very much fun doing, and we think we might plan on doing it again at some point.
I was going to ask, are there any exclusives, but that'll do, I think.
Well, there are no exclusives at the moment, but there will be some Bellowhead news not too distant future of an interesting variety, so
excellent.
Keep looking out for that.
And you're going to play me out with your recording of the Princess Royal. So thank you so much for coming on here. It's been great chatting to you, and I hope to catch up with you soon.
Oh, thanks, John.
Thanks to Squeezy John for his time and for his knowledge, and to the English Folk Dance and Song Society for their ongoing support of the Old Songs podcast. During this episode, you heard the following music in this order. You heard John Spires playing the Abingdon version of the Princess Royal on the Spires and Bowden album Bellow from 2003. You heard Spires and Bowden again playing the Bampton version of the Princess Royal on their album Vagabond from 2008. You heard Magpie Lane playing the Princess Royal on their 2006 album The Oxford Ramble. Then there was Clannad playing the original version of the tune under that original name, Mrs. McDermott. That was from their 1973 album Clannad.
Matt Green was up next, performing the tune While Dancing a Jig, which can be found on Pete Cooper's YouTube channel. I'll embed the video on the Tradfolk page related to this episode of the Old Songs podcast. The Unthanks were up after that. They were singing The Scarecrow Knows from the TV series Wurzel Gummidge that was released on a soundtrack album in December 2022. Jim Murray was heard singing Gypsies from his 2003 album Sweet England. And then we had The Princess Royal performed on the Morris On album released in 1972. You also had a snippet of Eliza Carthy and Nancy Kerr playing the B part to the tune on their 1995 album The Shape of Scrape. And that just leaves me to invite my illustrious guest back to perform his exclusive version, it's exclusive to the Old Songs podcast, that is, of the North Lee version of the Princess Royal, so close to his heritage, which he spoke about, of course, earlier in the conversation. Take it away, Squeezy.